This is Audible.
HarperCollins and Harper Audio present Dereliction of Duty. Lyndon Johnson, Robert McNamara, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the Lives That Led to Vietnam. By H.R. McMaster. This is the author. For Katie. Preface. Despite scores of books on the subject, the why and how of direct U.S. intervention in the Vietnam War remains unclear. The war continues to capture the public interest, in part, because looking back, its cost seems exorbitant, and would seem so even if the United States had won. The war took the lives of 58,000 Americans and well over 1 million Vietnamese. It left Vietnam in ruins and consumed billions of American dollars, nearly wrecking the American economy. Vietnam divided American society and inflicted on the United States one of the greatest political traumas since the Civil War. Indeed, the war's legacies proved to be as profound as the war was traumatic. It led Americans to question the integrity of their government as never before. 30 years later, after the end of the Cold War, the shadow of the American experience in Vietnam still hangs heavy over American foreign and military policy, and over American society. It would be impossible for an Army lieutenant obtaining his commission in 1984 not to be concerned with the experience of the Vietnam War. I thought that to better prepare myself to lead soldiers in combat, it was important to learn from the experiences of others, and the most recent U.S. war seemed as good a starting place as any. I read personal accounts written by junior officers, but found to my surprise that the Army I entered barely spoke of Vietnam. The emotions connected with sacrifices made in a lost war ran too deep to permit the veterans of that conflict to dwell on their experiences. Those who had remained in uniform seemed eager to forget and had turned their energies and talents toward building an organization capable of fighting and winning the next war. In 1991, as commander of an armored cavalry troop in the Persian Gulf War, it was clear to me that our unit's experience was dramatically different from the Vietnam accounts that I had read. The ease with which we could connect our combat mission to strategic objectives that seemed clear and attainable contrasted starkly with combat actions in Vietnam, which seemed to achieve nothing beyond adding more enemy dead to the weekly body count. I wondered how and why Vietnam had become an American war, a war in which men fought and died without a clear idea of how their actions and sacrifices were contributing to an end of the conflict. When I arrived at Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 1992 to begin my graduate work in American history, I began to seek answers to those questions. I discovered that the military's role in Vietnam decision-making was little understood and largely overlooked. By law, the Joint Chiefs of Staff were the principal military advisors to the President, the National Security Council, and the Secretary of Defense. That was not the role of the Joint Chiefs of Staff during the escalation of the Vietnam War. It became clear to me that I would need to understand the role of the President, his principal civilian advisors, and the JCS in the decision-making process. The timing was right. Recently declassified documents, newly opened manuscript collections, and the release of the official history of the JCS during the Vietnam War shed new light on the subject. I gained access to thousands of documents that had previously been unavailable to researchers and historians. Interviews with those close to the decision-making process, taped meetings and telephone conversations, and oral histories and memoirs of top civilian and military officials who served during this period placed the documentary record in the context of personalities and advisory relationships. The discoveries astonished me and I felt compelled to share them with others. Any interpretation of direct American intervention in the Vietnam War must address the question of responsibility for one of the greatest American foreign policy disasters of the 20th century. Assessing blame for the disaster in Vietnam, however, is beside the point. Much more important is to determine how and why key decisions were made, decisions that involved the United States in a war that it could not win at a politically acceptable level of commitment. Chapter 1. The New Frontiersman and the Old Guard, 1961 to October 1962. Allowing for reasonable exceptions and a wide latitude of variation, the typical New Frontiersman is about 46 years old, highly energetic, distinctly articulate, and refreshingly idealistic. In short, he has much in common with the man the American people have chosen as their president. M.B. Schnapper, 1961. The disaster of the Vietnam War would dominate America's memory of a decade that began with great promise. In the 1960 presidential election, John F. Kennedy narrowly defeated Dwight Eisenhower's vice president, Richard Nixon. Despite a narrow margin of victory, the new president exuded confidence. His clarion call, "Let us begin anew," evoked the prospect of a new era of prosperity and opportunity. Although he was only 5 years younger than Nixon, Kennedy at 43 seemed youthful and vigorous compared to his opponent and the old-timers of Eisenhower's administration. A witty, attractive man, Kennedy was a World War II hero and Pulitzer Prize-winning author who had gained considerable political experience as a congressman and senator. His rhetoric exhorted America's youth to pay any price and bear any burden to extend the virtues of their country to the rest of the world. The idealism that Kennedy seemed to personify would be lost in a place that, in 1960, was of little interest or significance to Americans. A campaign issue that Kennedy had taken up with some vigor was that of the need for reform in national defense strategy and the management of the Department of Defense. Truman Administration Defense Secretary Robert Lovett advised Kennedy that reform in the Pentagon would be painful, but was long overdue. He told him that his defense secretary should be an analytical statistician who can tear out the overlap, the empire building. Lovett urged the president-elect to consider the 44-year-old president of the Ford Motor Company, Robert Strange McNamara, for the job. When World War II began, Robert McNamara was serving on the business faculty at Harvard University, teaching the application of statistical analysis to management problems. Initially disqualified from military service because of his inability to pass an eye examination, he became a consultant to the War Department to develop statistical controls within the Army Air Corps supply system. After spending the first year of the war teaching at the Army Air Force's Statistical Control Officer's School, McNamara requested an assignment to the 8th Air Force in England. McNamara arrived in England in February 1943 and, after 3 weeks, sought a commission as a captain. The professor-turned-military officer became part of a traveling statistical control group that analyzed maintenance, logistics, and operational problems in England, India, China, and the Pacific. McNamara often met resistance from military officers who discounted his new methods. A lieutenant colonel in 1945, he left the Army an ardent believer in the need for statistical management and control over military organizations. After World War II, McNamara, with several of his Army Air Corps statistician colleagues, joined Ford. They were known collectively as the Whiz Kids, a term later associated with the young analysts McNamara brought with him to the Pentagon. At Ford, McNamara preferred the academic milieu of Ann Arbor to the corporate culture of suburban Detroit. His drive, ambition, and analytical talents led to his appointment in November 1960 as the first company president who was not a member of the Ford family. 1 month later, R. Sergeant Shriver, John F. Kennedy's brother-in-law, visited McNamara on behalf of the president-elect. Although he intended to remain at Ford, McNamara agreed to fly to meet Kennedy. Among the qualities that Kennedy admired was self-assurance. During his second meeting with Kennedy, McNamara surprised the president-elect and his brother Robert with his assertiveness. He handed Jack Kennedy a contract, stipulating that he be given free rein over appointments in the Department of Defense and not be expected to engage in purely social events. Kennedy read the document and passed it, unsigned, to his brother. McNamara seemed the man for the job. The Kennedy brothers swept McNamara out the front door of the brick Georgetown house and introduced the Secretary of Defense designate to the bevy of reporters waiting outside in the freezing cold. Kennedy worried most over the appointment of a Secretary of State. Reluctant to alienate any of his key Democratic constituencies, he settled on everyone's second choice, Dean Rusk. Rusk, a former Rhodes Scholar from Georgia, was a professor of government and dean of faculty at Mills College in California when, in 1940, he was ordered into active military service as an Army captain. He served initially in Washington as an intelligence analyst. With the advent of American involvement in World War II, Rusk left the Capitol for the headquarters of the China, Burma, and India Theater of Operations. The quality of the cables that the young staff officer sent to the War Department caught the eye of Army Chief of Staff George C. Marshall. General Marshall summoned Rusk to Washington, where he joined Colonel George A. Lincoln's Strategy and Policy Group to help develop long-range politico-military contingency plans. In 1946, Rusk joined the State Department and, in 1950, became Secretary of State Dean Acheson's assistant for Far Eastern Affairs. In 1952, he left the State Department to head the Rockefeller Foundation. During his years of government service, Rusk built a solid reputation for loyalty and trustworthiness within the Democratic establishment. The unprepossessing, introspective Rusk provided a conspicuous contrast to the confident, assertive McNamara. Lovett and Acheson had recommended Rusk enthusiastically, and after a brief interview, Kennedy decided to appoint him. Kennedy had considered McGeorge Bundy for Secretary of State, but concluded that he was too young. In 1953, Bundy, at 34, was appointed Dean of Harvard University's Faculty of Arts and Sciences. His formative years were spent in the best schools of the Northeast, Groton, Yale, Harvard, and in association with some of the most influential people in the 20th century United States. He assisted Henry Stimson, who had been William Howard Taft's Secretary of War, Herbert Hoover's Secretary of State, and Franklin Roosevelt's Secretary of War, in the preparation of his memoirs. He also helped Dean Acheson prepare a collection of his personal papers for publication. Bundy was known for abruptness and imperious demeanor with those he considered his intellectual inferiors, but he could also be effusive and engaging in a social setting. Kennedy chose him as Special Assistant for National Security Affairs, usually called National Security Advisor. Kennedy placed a premium on academic qualifications and superior intellect. McNamara, Rusk, and Bundy all shared distinguished academic backgrounds. Moreover, Kennedy wanted men who shared his broad interests and could engage in wide-ranging, informal discussions. Perhaps the most important determining factor of each man's relative influence would be his ability to establish a close personal rapport with the president. Rusk, who preferred established procedures and protocol, had difficulty adjusting to the president's freewheeling style. Socially, he remained distant from the president and was the only senior official Kennedy did not address by his first name. McNamara and Bundy would prove more adept at securing the president's confidence and affection. The president's personal style influenced the way he structured the White House staff to handle national security decision-making. Having no experience as an executive, Kennedy was unaccustomed to operating at the head of a large staff organization. He regarded Eisenhower's National Security Council, or NSC, structure as cumbersome and unnecessary. Immediately after taking office, he eliminated the substructure of the NSC by abolishing its two major committees, the Planning Board and the Operations Coordinating Board. Kennedy resolved not to use the NSC except for the pro forma consultation required by the National Security Act of 1947. In place of the formal Eisenhower system, Kennedy relied on an ad hoc, collegial style of decision-making in national security and foreign affairs. He formed task forces to analyze particular problems and met irregularly with an inner club of his most trusted advisors to discuss problems informally and weigh the advantages and disadvantages of potential courses of action. Kennedy's dismantling of the NSC apparatus diminished the voice of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in national security matters. Under Eisenhower, military officers connected with the JCS were assigned to the Planning Board and the Operational Control Board. Through these representatives, the JCS could place items important to the military on the NSC agenda. During NSC meetings, Eisenhower considered differing opinions and made decisions with all the chiefs in attendance. Kennedy's structural changes, his practice of consulting frankly with only his closest advisors, and his use of larger forums to validate decisions already made would transcend his own administration and continue as a prominent feature of Vietnam decision-making under Lyndon Johnson. Under the Kennedy-Johnson system, the Joint Chiefs lost the direct access to the president, and thus the real influence on decision-making that the Eisenhower NSC structure had provided. Diminished JCS access to the president reflected Kennedy's opinion of his senior military advisors. Kennedy and the young new frontiersmen of his administration viewed the Eisenhower JCS with suspicion. Against the backdrop of Kennedy's efforts to reform the Defense Department and under the strain of foreign policy crises, a relationship of mutual distrust between senior military and civilian officials would develop. 2 months after Kennedy assumed the presidency, tension between the new frontiersmen and the old guard escalated over a foreign policy blunder in the Caribbean. The old guard in the Pentagon were soon relegated to a position of little influence. The Bay of Pigs shattered the sense of euphoria and hopeful aspiration that surrounded the new frontiersmen during their first months in Washington. In early 1960, the Eisenhower administration had authorized the Central Intelligence Agency, or CIA, to form, arm, and train a Cuban exile force for the purpose of overthrowing Fidel Castro's government in Cuba. When Kennedy took office, a brigade of approximately 1,500 men located in secret Guatemalan bases comprised this Army of Liberation. Embarrassed by the anti-Castro training camps, President Miguel Ydigoras Fuentes asked Kennedy to have the force removed from Guatemalan soil by the end of April. Faced with the choice of using or losing the exile brigade, the president approved a plan designed to support the invasion while preserving his ability to deny U.S. involvement. After dark, on April 16, 1961, the invasion force set out for the Bay of Pigs, Cuba. The invaders soon discovered that their American destroyer escort would not accompany them after they moved to within 20 miles of their homeland. Any hopes of gaining surprise were futile. The Kennedy administration had failed in its attempts to suppress news articles that revealed the plan for a U.S.-sponsored invasion, and the invasion was a hot topic of conversation on the streets of Havana. Castro was awakened at 1 o'clock a.m. on April 17th with news of the brigade's arrival. Unmarked, antiquated planes attacked the Cuban Air Force Base, but failed to destroy many of Castro's fighters. Denied American air cover, the ships supporting the landing were either sunk or fled from the area. Castro's jet fighters attacked the exile brigade from above as his ground forces began pushing them back to the sea. The liberators were running out of ammunition. On April 18th, Kennedy, with the support of Secretary of Defense McNamara, fended off requests from the Joint Chiefs and others to provide direct American support to the besieged brigade. The next day, in the face of incessant attacks, the abandoned exile force surrendered. Of the approximately 1,300 men who actually reached the beaches, almost 1,200 were taken prisoner, and about 100 were killed in action. John Kennedy had not considered the consequences of going forward with the Bay of Pigs invasion. The president's informal style and structure of decision-making did not allow for a systematic review of the planned invasion of Cuba. Under Eisenhower, a White House intelligence office closely monitored CIA plans and operations. Eisenhower had approved only planning and preparation for the invasion. When Kennedy abolished the intelligence office of the Operational Control Board, he impeded his staff's ability to gain familiarity and take control of the Eisenhower administration's policies and programs. The CIA was able, therefore, to present the plan for the invasion as a decision already made by Kennedy's predecessor. Although the president took public responsibility for the Bay of Pigs failure, he placed a large measure of the blame for the disaster on poor military advice from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He thought that his senior military advisors should have been more assertive with their doubts about the operation's chances for success. For their part, the JCS believed that Kennedy's ire was misdirected. The president consulted the JCS only after he had made the decision to launch the invasion. The military services had provided personnel on special assignment to the CIA, but remained unaware of their activities. The chiefs were skeptical about the operation's chances of success and stated that the landing could only succeed if the landing force controlled the air. They blamed the president for not consulting them earlier and thought his decision to leave the landing force stranded on the beach reprehensible. The Bay of Pigs debacle not only exacerbated mutual distrust between the president and his senior military officers, but spurred an intense desire on the part of John Kennedy to overthrow the Castro regime. Meanwhile, another foreign policy challenge had developed in Laos, a landlocked nation in Southeast Asia, positioned among China, Cambodia, Thailand, North Vietnam, and South Vietnam. In its effort to deny control of the country to Pathet Lao communist guerrillas, the Eisenhower administration had alternately provided military assistance to and acted to weaken the Lao government in Vientiane. When Kennedy took office in January 1961, the Pathet Lao had seized key objectives on the strategically vital Plain of Jars and threatened the fragile American-supported government of Prince Bonhomme. By late April, the president was considering U.S. military intervention. Smarting from what they believed had been unfair criticism after the Bay of Pigs, the chiefs were determined that any commitment of U.S. military force not suffer from the indecision and lack of firepower that had been evident in the abortive Cuban invasion. They told Kennedy, unambiguously, that military action in Laos could involve the United States in a large-scale land war in Southeast Asia and might escalate into a confrontation with China. They recommended that if any troops were deployed, they should arrive in a strength of at least 60,000 men. Army General Lyman Lemnitzer, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Army Chief of Staff George H. Decker warned Kennedy not to take action unless he was prepared to use nuclear weapons to guarantee victory. A military commitment in Laos reminded Lemnitzer and Decker of the same sort of limited, costly, protracted commitment that the generals had experienced in Korea. After a meeting at the State Department on Laos, Rusk asked Lemnitzer, "Lem, do you think we can get the 101st Airborne Infantry Division in there?" The general responded, "We can get it in all right. It's getting it out that I'm worried about." During the Laotian crisis, the president was again dissatisfied with the advice of the Joint Chiefs, whose thinking he regarded as outmoded and unimaginative. He found the JCS estimate of the number of troops needed excessive and ordered only 10,000 Marines, then stationed in Japan, to prepare for deployment to Laos. He believed that strategic options in military affairs should give him more flexibility than a stark choice between inaction and large-scale commitment. Meanwhile, preparations for the deployment of the Marines, coupled with diplomatic activity, seemed to have a positive effect on Moscow's attitude toward the Laotian problem. Eventually, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev agreed to negotiations aimed at developing a neutral Laos. The May 1961 International Conference on Laos assembled in Geneva and lasted until July of the following year. The U.S. government considered the outcome less than favorable. The diplomatic settlement left the Pathet Lao in control of roughly the eastern half of the country, a region that North Vietnam used to supply and reinforce the Viet Cong insurgents in their fight against the American-backed South Vietnamese regime. The unfavorable Laotian settlement, combined with the apparent connection between American threats of Marine deployment and Soviet willingness to negotiate, reinforced Kennedy's opinion that JCS advice was of limited value and heightened the distrust between the president and his senior military advisors. The new frontiersmen were men of action, and the chief's reluctance to take military action short of a large-scale deployment upset them. Assistant Secretary of State Roger Hilsman and White House Assistant Michael Forrestal, son of the late Secretary of Defense, thought that the military had gone soft. With respect to Laos, they beat their chests until it comes time to do some fighting, and then they start backing down, Hilsman wrote in 1962. Because the front line against communism had not been drawn in Laos, South Vietnam would become the principal focus of U.S. policy in Southeast Asia. Under those circumstances, Kennedy brought into his administration a man who would exert great influence over two presidents' decisions to escalate American involvement in Vietnam. Reeling from the wave of public criticism following the Bay of Pigs, and aware of his increasingly troubled relationship with the JCS, Kennedy told his staff that he needed someone to be my advisor to see that I am not making a dumb mistake as commander-in-chief. To provide him with military advice and to coordinate the efforts of the White House staff, Defense Department, and intelligence agencies, the besieged president looked to former Army Chief of Staff Maxwell Davenport Taylor. Max Taylor seemed the model of the soldier statesman. Inspired by his Confederate grandfather's Civil War tales, Taylor pursued a military career with great enthusiasm from an early age. When his sixth grade teacher asked him to name his professional ambition, the young Taylor wrote, "Major General." 12 years later, he graduated fourth in the West Point class of 1922. A talented linguist, Taylor later returned to the military academy to teach Spanish and French. During assignments in China and Japan, he became proficient in Japanese. It was in part his reputation as both a warrior and a scholar that made the general attractive to Kennedy. Taylor earned a reputation as a successful combat commander during World War II. He began the war on General Marshall's secretariat, but soon rose to command the 101st Airborne Division in Europe. He returned to Asia in 1953 to lead the 8th Army in the closing months of the Korean War. In 1955, when Army Chief of Staff Matthew Ridgway retired without a second 2-year term because of his unhappy relations with the Eisenhower administration, Taylor was named his successor. Like Ridgway, Taylor soon became frustrated by his inability to persuade the president or his indecisive Secretary of Defense, Charles Wilson, that a larger and more capable army was vital to America's national security. Taylor served a full 4 years, but retired 18 months before Eisenhower relinquished the presidency to John F. Kennedy. The 58-year-old had been a general officer for 16 years. When he retired, Taylor was thoroughly fed up with the Pentagon and its ways. Taylor's frustration stemmed in part from Eisenhower's subordination of military policy to domestic economic priorities. Eisenhower believed that the United States, engaged in a protracted competition with the Soviet Union, had to husband American economic strength as the basis for prevailing in the Cold War. When the fighting in Korea ended on July 26, 1953, the president developed a lower-cost strategy for national defense, the New Look. The New Look rejected Ridgway's and Taylor's arguments that the American military forces must remain balanced in size or configuration with those of the Soviet Union, and relied instead on the military doctrine of massive retaliation. To maintain a credible deterrent against communist aggression, massive retaliation gave top priority in the defense budget to the Air Force and nuclear weaponry. Under the New Look, the Army dropped from 20 to 14 divisions, a reduction of nearly 500,000 soldiers, while the Air Force expanded from 115 to 137 wings and added 30,000 airmen. To achieve economy as well as security in national defense, the New Look sought to combine the threat of nuclear force with alliances, ready reserves, and psychological and covert operations. On January 12, 1954, Secretary of State John Foster Dulles announced in a speech before the Council on Foreign Relations that the administration would depend primarily on a great capacity to retaliate instantly to achieve a maximum deterrent at a bearable cost. In addition to his desire to cut costs, the lesson of the Korean War, that the American public would not support a protracted, limited conflict in a distant land, weighed heavily on Eisenhower. In contrast to Eisenhower, Kennedy had been sympathetic to Taylor's argument that massive retaliation be supplanted with a military doctrine of flexible response. In The Uncertain Trumpet, a scathing critique of Ike's defense policy, published soon after the Army Chief's retirement, Taylor called for the unqualified renunciation of the doctrine of massive retaliation. He wrote that reliance on the threat of blasting our enemies from the face of the earth with atomic bombing if they commit aggression against us or our friends offers no alternative other than reciprocal suicide or retreat. His proposed military strategy of flexible response would give multiple choices to our political leaders and allow them to cope with threats of many gradations, extending from subversive insurgency to limited war, conventional or nuclear, and finally to unlimited nuclear war. To rebuild its ability to fight conventional wars, Taylor argued that the United States had to expand and reinforce its ground forces overseas and create a robust strategic reserve of ground and air forces on its own soil. Kennedy became enamored of Maxwell Taylor's ideas. 2 weeks before declaring his candidacy for the presidency, Kennedy wrote to Evan Thomas, Maxwell Taylor's editor, with an assessment of The Uncertain Trumpet. The book had persuaded Kennedy that we have not brought our conventional war capabilities into line with the necessities. The senator thought that Taylor's critique of American defense policy and structure deserved reading by every American. It was Kennedy's and Taylor's first contact in what would become a relationship of mutual respect and great affection. Taylor's ideas were evident in Kennedy's first presidential address on defense policy, in which he stated that any potential aggressor contemplating an attack on any part of the free world with any kind of weapons, conventional or nuclear, must know that our response will be suitable, selective, swift, and effective. Taylor would help Kennedy effect a doctrinal shift that influenced deepening U.S. involvement in Vietnam. But first, Kennedy needed Taylor to redress the balance of the president's troubled relationship with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. On April 21st, President Kennedy telephoned Taylor, who had just taken over as president of the recently opened Lincoln Center Performing Arts Complex in New York City. Distraught over the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy asked Taylor to come to Washington immediately for consultation. 9 weeks later, Taylor returned to active military duty to take an unprecedented White House position as military representative of the president. The president outlined his duties. 1. The military representative is a staff officer to advise and assist the president with regard to those military matters that reach him as commander-in-chief of the armed forces. The military representative is not interposed between the president and any of his statutory advisors or advisory bodies, such as the Secretary of Defense, JCS, or the NSC, but maintains close liaison with them and is prepared to give his personal views to assist the president in reaching decisions. He is available to represent the president when the latter desires senior military representation at home or abroad. 2. The military representative has an analogous function of advice and assistance in the field of intelligence. He is not interposed between the president and the DCI, or Director of Central Intelligence, or the intelligence community, but watches the functioning of the intelligence apparatus of the government to assure that it meets the present and future needs of the president. 3. In the so-called Cold War planning and action, the military representative will check on the use of our military and intelligence assets and verify the effectiveness of their integration and employment. 4. The military representative has no command authority except within his own office. He may, however, call directly on any department or agency of the government for information necessary for the discharge of his responsibilities. Qualifications in the text reflected Kennedy's desire to avoid criticism from the JCS and members of Congress, who might view the position as an infringement on the statutory responsibilities of the Joint Chiefs. The Joint Chiefs had reason to believe that Taylor would assert himself in areas that had been the sole responsibility of the JCS. Taylor's experience as Army Chief of Staff led him to recommend radical reform in the JCS organization. He had left the Eisenhower administration exhausted from well-nigh continuous conflict with his civilian leaders and fellow officers of the Joint Chiefs. Taylor's difficult experience stemmed in part from the institutional conflict endemic in American democratic government. After World War II, questions of defense policy figured prominently in the continuing power struggle between the executive branch and Congress. Dissent from members of the Joint Chiefs could weaken the president's position with the legislature and undermine an administration's policy decisions. Although Eisenhower had described the chief's statutory right to appeal to Congress as legalized insubordination, Taylor disapproved of the president's expectation that military officers mold their advice to the views and feelings of superiors and accept public responsibility for policy decisions that they opposed. Taylor thought that Eisenhower was obsessed with loyalty and team play and castigated him for creating an environment in which members of the administration pressured the JCS to accept a preconceived politico-military line. In Taylor's view, the military's ultimate loyalty to the Constitution and the people, as embodied by their congressional representatives, outweighed personal fealty to the commander-in-chief. He believed that Congress and the public should be aware of the dissenting views of the nation's top military leaders. However, Taylor revised his opinions on the proper relationship between the military and the commander-in-chief when he returned to government service under Kennedy. The formation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff reflected the tension between the need to integrate military advice into the national security policy process and the desire to retain civilian control over the defense establishment. In January 1942, President Franklin D. Roosevelt had established the JCS to satisfy the exigencies of America's newly formed military alliance with Great Britain. During World War II, the JCS planned and directed U.S. military strategy, managed materiel and manpower, and coordinated among the nation's military allies. In 1944, Congress began hearings on post-war defense organization and examined the issue in earnest after the war. After a two-year debate, Congress passed the National Security Act of 1947 to provide a comprehensive program for the future security of the United States. The Act and its amendments in 1949 established the Central Intelligence Agency, created the National Security Council to coordinate policy for the president, and created a loose confederation of the armed services under the Office of the Secretary of Defense, or OSD. The new Department of Defense consisted of OSD, the JCS, and the military departments of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. The Marine Corps remained within the Department of the Navy. The Act, which was essentially a compromise between Army and Navy proposals, shifted responsibility away from individual service secretaries and gave OSD authority over the national military establishment. The legislation stipulated that the full-time members of the JCS include a chairman and the military heads of the Army, Navy, and Air Force. The Commandant of the Marine Corps would vote only on matters directly affecting his service. Congress provided the JCS with a staff to aid the chiefs in their advisory and executive functions. Congress designated the Joint Chiefs as the principal military advisors to the President, the National Security Council, and the Secretary of Defense. The legislators concluded that the most senior professional officers from each of the services could offer the best military advice to the national command authority. Testifying before the Senate Committee on Naval Affairs on May 1, 1946, Secretary of the Navy James V. Forrestal argued that reliance on a single military genius would risk mistakes of judgment. Meeting together, each chief would have to justify his case before a group of intelligent partners. Congress was persuaded that the JCS, meeting together as a corporate body, comprised the best forum from which to obtain military advice. However, inter-service competition for scarce resources impinged on the chief's ability to cooperate in the interest of national security. Differences among the chiefs centered on the definition of roles and missions of the services. The way the chiefs defined roles and missions determined force size and structure and the research, development, and procurement of new weapon systems. Conflicts between the services led to inefficiency and redundancy. During his second term as president, Dwight Eisenhower grew increasingly concerned that if the chiefs did not cooperate, transcending narrow service views, civilians less familiar with the complexities of warfare, such as the Secretary of Defense, might assume the chief's responsibilities. Eisenhower sought a structural solution to the problems of service parochialism and inefficiency. The Defense Reorganization Act of 1958 aimed to centralize control over the services, remove redundancies, streamline command channels, and provide for a tighter civilian control at the Pentagon. Although Congress expected the act to affirm JCS responsibility to provide military advice and plan military operations with unified commands, which are geographical commands that included forces from all four services, the law permitted the OSD to share the chief's advisory role and removed the JCS from the chain of command that ran from the president to the commanders in the field. The Secretary of Defense would direct the unified commands, while the Joint Chiefs performed executive functions, such as translating guidance from the Secretary into military orders and directives. Although the chiefs retained their charter as principal military advisors, the wide latitude given to the Secretary of Defense to provide for more effective and efficient administration would permit a strong-willed secretary to concentrate power in his hands. The erosion of the chief's power and influence, which Eisenhower had predicted, was closer to becoming a reality. Centralization in the Department of Defense did nothing to attenuate inter-service rivalry. Indeed, Eisenhower's defense policies intensified competition between the services. In the uncertain trumpet, Taylor advocated even greater centralization of JCS advisor responsibilities. Deeply affected by conflict among the chiefs, Taylor wrote that he would dissolve the organization and replace it with a single defense chief of staff who, as the senior military officer of the U.S. government, would report directly to the Secretary of Defense and the President. Taylor recognized that pressures from within the military services colored the advice of JCS members. If a chief were seen as abandoning that service's interests, he risked losing all credibility and respect. Taylor's plan called for an advisory body independent of the military services, called the Supreme Military Council. The council would consist of senior officers from each of the services who were either retired or on their last tour of duty. Aware of Taylor's views, the JCS chairman, General Lemnitzer, had been less than enthusiastic about Taylor's appointment as military representative of the president, and Kennedy moved to defuse potential criticism from the Pentagon. Brigadier General Chester Ted Clifton, the president's military assistant, telephoned McNamara's military assistant to discuss the formal announcement of the president's decision to place Maxwell Taylor on the White House staff. Clifton observed that Taylor's duties would be laid out very carefully so that members of Congress and the press sympathetic to the JCS would not deem Taylor an usurper of Joint Chiefs' advisor responsibilities. The White House statement would say only that the matter had been discussed with the Secretary of Defense and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The President directed, however, that General Lemnitzer attend the formal announcement and stand by to come out with a hurrah. Kennedy also indicated his expectation that Secretary McNamara publicly convey his enthusiasm in some fashion. The President privately acknowledged that Taylor's responsibilities could easily have been performed by the Pentagon's senior military men. He was not only dissatisfied with the Joint Chiefs' advice, but also frustrated by his inability to establish with them the kind of friendly rapport that he enjoyed with the rest of his staff and with many of his cabinet officials. To Kennedy, generals and admirals were too formal, traditional, and unimaginative. Bundy confided to Taylor's principal assistant that Kennedy would never really feel secure about the military until young generals of his own generation, in whom he has confidence, filled the top uniform positions in the defense establishment. Bundy knew that it was important to Kennedy that the top military men be able to conduct a conversation with the president to give him a feeling of confidence and reassurance. Taylor would strive to satisfy the president's need. Kennedy's new personal advisor found the president an amazingly attractive man, intelligent, with a ready wit, personal charm, and ability to inspire loyalty in the people around him. He soon cultivated a warm friendship with the president and his family. Taylor knew that the chiefs and the Secretary of Defense viewed him as a competing voice in national security issues. The retired general moved to head off potential animosities and assured his old friend Lemnitzer that it would be more of an ally than a source of competition. He told Lemnitzer that his close personal relations with the president and his entourage would help ensure that the chief's advice reached the president. When he arrived in Washington on April 22nd, Taylor's first responsibility was to conduct an investigation of the decision to mount the Bay of Pigs invasion. Although he concluded that the chiefs were not directly responsible for the misadventure, he criticized them for not warning the president more urgently of the dangers. When the administration sought military advice on narrow questions about the operation, the chiefs gave competent answers, but offered no overall assessment because they hadn't been asked. Taylor concluded that relations between the commander-in-chief and the JCS had reached crisis level. To address the problem, he drafted a memorandum outlining what the president ought to expect from the chiefs in the area of military advice. The memo ordered the JCS to initiate advice as well as respond to specific requests. Moreover, the chief should fit military requirements into the overall context of any situation, recognizing that the most difficult problem in government is to combine all assets in a unified, effective pattern. The president used Taylor's memo as the basis for a meeting with the chiefs on May 27, 1961. 1 month later, he signed a slightly revised version, which he designated National Security Action Memorandum, or NSAM 55. Taylor's memorandum revealed how much his few weeks' association with the Kennedy White House had changed his thinking about the advisory role of the JCS. When he left the Eisenhower administration, he believed that the Joint Chiefs should provide narrowly focused military advice with limited, if any, attention to political or economic factors, since these components of national strategy had qualified spokesmen elsewhere in the governmental structure. After witnessing the crisis that grew out of mutual dislike and distrust between the president and the Joint Chiefs, Taylor abandoned his previous view that the JCS should not take into account the views and feelings of superiors and supplanted it with an acknowledgement of the importance of an intimate, easy relationship born of friendship and mutual regard between the president and the chiefs. He revised the conviction that he had held as Army Chief of Staff that the JCS should remain a non-political body whose loyalty to the Constitution and the people superseded allegiance to any particular administration. When Taylor arrived in Washington, the Joint Chiefs were in the middle of scrambling to keep up with the new Defense Secretary's demands for information and quantitative justifications for existing policies and programs. President Kennedy had given McNamara 30 days to accomplish a complete review of defense policy and the organization of the Pentagon. McNamara was to develop a program to eliminate waste and inefficiency. Anxious to provide active, imaginative, and decisive leadership in the Department of Defense and abandon the passive practice of simply refereeing the disputes of traditional and partisan factions that had characterized the efforts of Eisenhower's defense secretaries, the new secretary undertook a comprehensive analysis of his department. The Joint Chiefs of Staff were unable to respond to McNamara's demands fast enough, and their cumbersome administrative system exacerbated the administration's unfavorable opinion of them. Any issue that came before the chiefs first went to action officers of each of the services who worked on a flimsy copy of the proposal. When the action officers reached consensus, they forwarded the issue on buff paper to experienced colonels called planners. Each planner incorporated his services position into the paper. The paper, now green in color, rose to the three-star operations deputies of each service who, if in agreement with the position in the paper, acted for the chiefs. If the operations deputies could not agree, or if the matter was of critical importance, the issue went before the chiefs themselves. If the JCS could not reach a consensus opinion on the subject, the dissenting members prepared letters of non-concurrence and forwarded them to the Secretary of Defense for decision. The system, based on compromise at every level, often resulted in ambiguous, watered-down proposals. Inter-service rivalry complicated an already cumbersome administrative system. Since the Air Force had become an independent service in 1947, the bickering over the organization and employment of military aviation which had begun in the early 1920s, had worsened. Historian Earl Tilford Jr. emphasized that the Air Force, like an illegitimate child at the family reunion, felt less comfortable with its origins, and all the more so since its primary reason for being was based on the unproven doctrine of strategic bombing. The Marines constantly felt threatened by the Army. The Navy, Air Force, and Army each sought important roles within American nuclear strategy and continental defense. Each service feared that another might usurp its role and thereby undercut its structure, its ability to develop future weapons, and thus its ability to wage war. Split decisions in the JCS often resulted from one or more of the services challenging another's justification for the development or procurement of particular weapons. This unhealthy competition often took on the character of an argument between selfish children and undercut further the credibility of the Joint Chiefs as an advisory body. McNamara quickly lost patience with the Chief's unresponsiveness and squabbling. His answer to the mutually reinforcing problems of parochialism and administrative inefficiency became familiar: increased centralization in the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Kennedy gave his new Secretary of Defense carte blanche, and McNamara took advantage of it. Drawing on his experience with analytical methods and statistics, he forced new management techniques on a reluctant department. He brought in an army of bright young analysts to assist him and used the wide latitude given the Secretary of Defense in the Defense Reorganization Act of 1958 to create a staff structure that mirrored military staff functions. Freed from dependence on the JCS for analysis, McNamara exerted civilian control over what had before been almost exclusively military prerogatives. McNamara's principal staff included young men such as Department of Defense General Counsel John McNaughton, a Harvard Law School professor who replaced Paul Nitze as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs in 1963. Special Assistant Adam Yarmolinsky, a longtime Kennedy aide. Charles J. Hitch, former president of the University of California, and the man some referred to as the chief whiz kid, Elaine Entevin, for whom McNamara created a new Office of Systems Analysis. The defense secretary gave his team full backing, and the young civilians discharged their responsibilities and exerted their authority with vigor. McNamara's whiz kids were like-minded men who shared their leader's penchant for quantitative analysis and suspicion of proposals based solely on military experience. Many of them had worked in think tanks and research corporations such as RAND, and they were eager to apply their techniques to the problems of the Defense Department. Taylor recalled that cost-effectiveness charts appeared on all the walls, and a whole host of requests for information and advice flooded the JCS. The two most important offices were Paul Nitze's International Security Affairs, or ISA, and Elaine Entevin's Systems Analysis Divisions. Entevin quickly became McNamara's point man in establishing firm civilian control over the Defense Department. His flair for quantitative analysis was exceeded only by his arrogance. Entevin held military experience in low regard and considered military men intellectually inferior. He likened leaving military decision-making to the professional military to allowing welfare workers to develop national welfare programs. Entevin suggested that military experience can be a disadvantage because it discourages seeing the larger picture. He and many of his colleagues believed that most people in the Department of Defense simply tried to advance their particular project or their service or their department. He was convinced that there was very little in the typical officer's early career that qualifies him to be a better strategic planner than a graduate of the Harvard Business School. He used statistics to analyze defense programs and issues, and then gave the Secretary of Defense and the President information needed to make decisions. Entevin saw no limits to the applicability of his methods. McNamara's autocratic style and the condescending attitude of his young civilian assistants